Good evening, everybody. Brian Alvarez here with a brand new edition of After Dark Radio. We've got a great show here for you this Friday evening. Going to be joined later on in this program by Steven Eisenstadt. We're going to be talking about dream tending. I got a lot of questions about dreams. I'm going to talk a little bit about that with Carl Stern here today as well. I never remember my dreams, but when I do, they're very strange. So we're going to talk about that with Steven Eisenstadt. What is dream tending? Talk about his book as well. It's going to be a very interesting show that's coming up in a little while. But first off, as always, we are joined here by Carl Stern of CarlStern.com. Going to be talking all of the news, which is available. AfterDarkRadioShow.com. That is the website. Head up there and check it out. We've got brand new stories up there most days. And you can head up there as well to our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/AfterDarkRadioShow. Join in the discussions. And Carl, how you doing today?
I'm doing great, Brian. The weather here has been tremendous for the last week or so, and it just, I don't know, it's the changing of the seasons. I love it. We've had a hot summer, and now it's cooling down. It's just absolutely perfect. And I love October. I mean, Halloween has to be one of my favorite holidays, far and away. I just love the campiness of it, the costume parties and so forth, and I love Halloween. I can't wait for this year. I'm going to hold a big Halloween party here at my house, and we're going to dress up and have all kinds of fun, and After Dark, that's got to be the official holiday of After Dark is Halloween.
What are you dressing up as, Carl?
Oh, you're going to love this, Brian. I'm dressing up as a 1800s era pro wrestler.
Really?
Yes, with the gigantic mustache, the suspenders, and the whole nine yards.
Now, are you doing this legit, growing a real mustache, or have you got a fake mustache you're going to put on?
Well, make no mistake about it, I can grow the manliest of manly mustaches, but I'm not much for the mustache. I'm like the anti-law enforcement officer, which is my job, and I hate all the clones that wear mustaches, so I never keep one myself, but I can grow, in fact, a manly mustache, but I'm afraid I'm going to have to purchase one for this particular occasion.
All right, now before we get into some of the news today, I suppose this is actually, it's actually one of the biggest news stories in the entire world, the death of Steve Jobs. We've talked many times on this show about our love of, for example, the iPad. I've got an iPad too. It's saves my life. And of course, you've got the first edition of the iPad as well, and I've got my iPhone. And
I was with you when you bought your iPad.
That's right. I had to go all the way to where were we?
We were well outside Atlanta, Georgia. You were across the country to get an iPad.
That's right. I see. When the iPad came out, I thought I'm going to wait for the iPad too. You know, the second generation is going to be a little better. It's going to be a little faster. I can wait. So I waited, and then, of course, the day that it was released, I was one of those people that, in fact, stood in line to get an iPad, and the line stretched, like, I don't know, 18 miles or something like that, and literally, I swear, as God is my witness, the guy in front of me got the last iPad. I'm not kidding, and there were no iPads anywhere in Seattle, and we ended up, I was out there in your neck of the woods on a trip. And I said, Carl, we need to get an iPad. And I believe, a Target locator, an iPad Target locator on the internet, maybe even on your iPad. And we went out to a Target out in the middle, literally the middle of nowhere. And I managed to pick one up. And thank God for that. But a very sad day with the death of Steve Jobs.
Yeah, and, I was reading an article today where apparently a forward thinker like he always was, apparently Steve Jobs has left 4 years worth of plans for the future of Apple and some of the things he wanted to see done and developed over the next 4 years. So his legacy is going to continue to live on. And it's a very sad story. I mean, he died at a rather young age and had a long battle with cancer that was very much in the public eye. And it's unfortunate. I mean, he really is one of the great minds of our generation. He and Bill Gates, the world really owes a lot to their technological advances and stuff and the companies they founded and much of the, certainly maybe somebody else would have come along and have innovated things, but we certainly, technology went in a very distinct and direction because of Steve Jobs And it really is a tragedy. Whether you like Apple products or whether you're an Apple hater or whatever, that's irrelevant to the fact that he really did set the trend for how technology went over really the last 20 years or so.
You know, I don't think a lot of people know this, but you can thank Steve Jobs in some ways for this show and for our other website as well, WrestlingObserver.com. When we first started the website back in 2005, and I was just thinking of ideas, and I was putting our wrestling newsletter online, and you know, we came up with the idea of what if we did some audio shows, some podcasts, and we just recorded them on a little voice recorder and put them online. And you know, eventually, obviously, the idea was, hey, you should put these on iTunes. You know, you should put a free show up on iTunes every few weeks and try and convince people to sign up that way. And so we very early on, we were one of the first wrestling podcasts on iTunes. And that podcast, the free shows that we put on iTunes, has grown the website more than any other single thing. From 2005 to 2008, the website exploded. And it was all people signing up. I shouldn't say all of them, but there were a huge number of people that signed up as a result of the free shows that we put up on iTunes. And the growth was such that eventually we brought on Dave Meltzer, and now we have what we have today, the empire, as I like to call it. And this radio show, After Dark, is an offshoot of that empire. And really, it all goes back to building the site up through free shows made available on iTunes. So had that technology not existed, I don't even know where anything would be now today. I don't know where this website would be, if it would even exist in this form. You know, it's a lot of, I always think back and I just go, man, you know, without iTunes, if we tried this, in fact, we did try this in about the year 1999, 2000, we tried a website and it failed horribly. It was a terrible failure, but it really took off in large part because of iTunes and the availability of getting those shows out for free to wrestling fans.
Well, and again, too, it really took the, it took technology in a very distinct direction, especially with the iPhone and the whole rise of the smartphone genre. I mean, it at your fingertips now. I mean, you have audio, video, internet. You have all this information readily available. And I'm not saying that it wouldn't have come about maybe even a different form without Steve Jobs, but certainly he popularized the method and he refined it and brought it to the masses, and it's one of those things that caught on. And it's funny, a friend of mine are often, as we stand around talking and we can't think of something and we're sitting there trying to scratch our brains, he'll often say, you know, if only there was a device that we could ask a question to and it would give us the answer, as he says rhetorically, as we, you know, Google it or go to a website or whatever. And really it is, you don't think about it as much as it, I think it really should be, that effectively the sum of all human knowledge is available on our telephone right now if we just access it. And that's, I mean, that has all kinds of possibilities for the advancement of us as a culture if we just, you know, were to take advantage of it. Now, it's certainly not always used that way, obviously, but it's there. I mean, it's there regardless. And Jobs, through his many innovations, has really popularized that.
Steven Eisenstadt is on the show today. We're going to be talking about dreaming and dream tending. And as I was doing some research and reading up about him and watching some videos, I really got to thinking about how strange dreams are. And obviously my first question for him will be, what are dreams? It's obviously a very important question. But, you know, I know I dream. But I wake up in the morning and I never, ever remember my dreams. I shouldn't say ever. Rare occasions. Once a month, maybe. Once every couple of months, I'll wake up and go, man, that was a weird dream. But in general, I wake up and they're gone. Never to be seen again. And is it like that with you as well? Or do you remember all of your dreams vividly?
I used to remember more of my dreams than I do now. It seems like the older I get, the less vivid my dreams are and the less recall I have of them. But I think it's a fascinating subject because it's one of the most under-researched fields out there, when you think about it in this context, Brian, you realize that everybody has dreams, and it's something we never think about often. We never talk about, but when you consider that how much of the world's history has revolved around religion and countries have risen and fallen based on religion. There are so many different religions and different cultures, and many of those religions are strongly dream-based, either founded through dreams or have significant foundations with dreams or visions or something people have had to form these. So in a way, you could say a vast amount of human history has actually been dictated or at least sent down a certain path by dreams. Yet it's one of the things that we never research. There's not a lot of information out there, and when it is researched, it goes, it seems like, in the supernatural direction. And I was reading up on Dr. Steven Eisenstadt's website and some of the stuff he talks about with dream tending, and it does seem like he kind of takes that somewhat supernatural approach to it. But at the same time, a lot of the stuff he has, there's a great PDF on his website that's entitled simply "What Is Dream Tending?" And it's an interesting read. It's several pages long and very detailed. And I would certainly encourage everybody to go download that PDF and read it after listening to the show, especially because it's one of those things again that has influenced so much of human history. Yet we don't sit around and think that much about it. What are dreams? What are they? Are they some sort of communication from a higher power? Is it some sort of extra-dimensional interaction, which seems to be what Eisenstadt somewhat suggests in some of his research? Is it memories? Is it some of our memories? Is it memories encoded in the DNA of our ancestors that we're reliving and uploading? I mean, there's so much. Is it there just needs to be a lot more research into it, and it's one of the things that everybody does, and yet there's so little that's been done about it.
On the website right now is actually several stories. I'm not sure how many we're going to get a chance to get into today, but one of them I wanted to talk about in terms of technology is the story of the team that is working on a bodysuit that could allow individuals paralyzed from the neck down to walk. And I always, when Christopher Reeve, Superman, Christopher Reeves got paralyzed, and, you know, his goal was to walk again. And I firmly believed at the time that the day would come when, of all people, Superman was going to walk again. I really thought that this was going to happen. And unfortunately, he passed away. I was very sad that day. I just always felt that, you know, I don't know if a full solution is right around the corner, but at the rate that technology is expanding, the day is going to come where if he had survived, he would have walked again. And this team here, they are in the midst of they're attempting to create a full body suit that a paralyzed person would be put inside, and they want this done in time for the 2014 World Cup. Before the first kickoff, I guess, they want this individual to walk out onto the field in this suit, someone who had been paralyzed from the neck down. And a lot of, you know, I have a friend, in fact, that ended up, a friend of my wife got paralyzed in a horse racing accident as well. And, you know, very young, in their 20s. And I always just thought, you know, just hold on. You know, I think the day is coming, and the day may be right around the corner.
That's one of the fields that I think we've lagged in technological advancements. When you think about it, it's a simple concept. Create an exoskeleton or some sort of a device that aids a paralyzed person in walking. And it's such a, you know, an obvious and simple concept. And with the amount of technological advances we've had over the last 25, 30, even 40 years, you would have thought we would have already been doing that by now. I mean, you know, I sit here in front of a 50-something inch plasma television that's, you know, weighs half of what, you know, the 19-inch television I had when I was a teenager weighed, and yet we have people still being pushed around in wheelchairs. I mean, it seems to me like we may be applying technology in the wrong direction sometimes. It, one of the things that a lot of people don't know about me, Brian, is that when I was 15 years old, I broke my neck in a motorcycle accident. And fortunately, I was didn't sustain a serious spinal cord injury, but it was within millimeters of having done so. And so it's always been one of the things that's really caught my attention as something that needs to be done. And when you look at, like, robotic limbs and stuff for people who have had amputations and whatever, it just seems to me like we should be way further ahead than we are in that field. And it's great to hear that somebody is actively that close to unveiling something. And I can't wait. All the best luck in the world. I hope they're taking advantage of every dime available to them to do that. And the same goes with stem cell research and things of that nature, that we can get folks who have been catastrophically injured in accidents back to mobility again.
Also on the website, AfterDarkRadioShow.com, got a couple of interesting stories here, including some interesting videos, a cigar-shaped UFO of some sort. We've got a video of an invisibility cloak of sorts. It's actually video of an object underwater that is made to vanish before our eyes. That's been talked about a while. And we've got a story about USA and Russian scientists targeting elusive Siberian snowman. There is a team heading to Siberia to investigate reports of a tall, skinnier, I guess they said, than a lot of people report in terms of Bigfoot in the United States, but what could be a Neanderthal, they believe. They are heading out to investigate that. And Carl, any thoughts on any of these stories?
Yeah, I watched the cigar-shaped UFO video, and to me that seems like some sort of space junk. I mean, it's the return of a missile test or some sort of space-launched vehicle or something returning to Earth. I mean, that's a very clear video. It doesn't strike me as something that's necessarily been hoaxed. I just think it's something that has a legitimate explanation of something that's followed back to Earth. When you see something like that, it's hard to get perspective on something that's up in the sky. My friend and I, several years ago, we were just kind of horsing around and goofing off, and we had obtained this helium tank from a place where his wife worked, and they had were doing a party, and so they had this helium tank left over and some balloons, and we were just, you know, goofing off and launching these things in the air and stuff at night, and we got to tying those little glow bands around them that like the kids wear around their wrists and stuff. We were tying them on there, and it was just the most eerie-looking thing floating up because you had no perspective. You could not tell if this was a six-inch round glow-in-the-dark wrist bracelet, or if it was a three-mile-long spacecraft just higher up in the sky against the night sky. It was impossible to gauge any sort of depth or size perception with that. And I think that's what happens with a lot of these things here. You can't really judge how big it is or whatever against the you know, you see this optical illusion all the time as the moon crests the horizon. It looks like it's gigantic, you know, against the backdrop of the key of the trees and so forth. But as it gets completely overhead, it looks a lot smaller. Well, it's actually the same size. You're just seeing an optical illusion. And the same thing goes for, like, the cigar-shaped object. I mean, you can't tell how big the thing is. There's no nothing to reference it by. And so I think that's easily explainable as some sort of space junk or a missile that's returning to Earth from some sort of test or something like that. One of the things that I did notice on there and I wanted to make mention of before I get off here today, because someone asked on Facebook to bring this up, and that was the beard cutting of the Amish.
Yes.
Attacks apparently in Ohio of a subset of the Amish culture there. Apparently there is some I don't even know what you call it, hazing, bullying, I don't even know, but some of the, it seems like a subset of the Amish community up there is attacking other members and shaving their beards, which apparently has some sort of religious significance amongst that community. And I was shocked. So, because the first thing I thought when I saw the headline was, you know, some sort of hate crime or something, but apparently this was within their own community. And so I got to doing a little research and reading, and this is something that's gone on for really as long as the Amish have existed, all the way back to when they were founding the Anabaptist movement over in Europe. Apparently there's always been this sort of, like, ultimate insult is to shave their beards and so forth. So I guess it's one of those things that we just don't hear about because it's a subculture that we don't hear a lot about because they shy away from media and so forth. But it's a very bizarre and very troubling thing that apparently it's a type of assault on one another.
I wanted to go back very quickly to the cigar-shaped tube. My only problem with the theory that it is a returning piece of space junk is, wouldn't that have hit the Earth and we would know about it?
I think it would. I think we don't know that it didn't. Just from the again, that's what I was saying about perspective. I mean, it could have fell. I bring up this one point from several months ago. If you remember, there was all kinds of news reports that a missile had been launched off the coast of California, and there was all this videotape from a news helicopter and stuff, and it actually turned out to be a contrail from a jet flying at a just an odd perspective from the film site. And so, again, always sees this thing in the air, and it gives the appearance of flying, but through the zoom and so forth, the thing may have fell in the ocean, you know, for all we know, or out in the desert where it was supposed to fall. And the thing could, again, without perception, we don't know, the thing could have fell hundreds of miles from where it was being filmed and just looked like it was flying, because once it contacts the horizon, you don't know if it went across the horizon or crashed to Earth or whatever. That's just from viewing the video, that's kind of what my perspective of it was.
Yeah, it is tough looking at the video because, again, as you noted, I mean, how far away is it? I mean, is it stationary? Is it moving quickly? It's really hard to say. I mean, you know, in the comment section here on YouTube, there are a lot of people thinking, oh, you know, it looks like it's a balloon of some sort, which it very well could be. It is way up there, certainly it appears. But, you know, the camera, the zoom and such, it's just really hard to get any sort of perspective on it. But I would say more likely a balloon of some sort than a falling piece of space junk, just because I think if it fell, I mean, the video is over a minute long, so that's an awful long time for it to be in the air without you know, hitting ground somewhere. It seems to be rather stationary in the air. But I don't know. I do not know what it is. It's very strange. It's up on the website right now. So go up there and check that out, afterdarkradioshow.com. Any thoughts on the Siberian Bigfoot expedition? Expedition?
Well, I hope to find something.
I hope to find something.
One of the things I do want to ask about, and I haven't heard an update on this, is the Bigfoot special that is going to be coming out, where they apparently have tested the DNA, and if I'm not mistaken, one of your past guests was involved in that project as well. Do you have an update on the that Bigfoot documentary that I thought was coming out sometime this fall?
Oh, Jeff Meldrum?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't really have an update. There are a lot of, I hear about these documentaries all the time, and something always seems to come up. There is no update as far as I have heard. I think several months ago we had, I forget the name of it off the top of my head. What the heck was it? Something Project. But I've really heard no update on that as of the time we're recording this. So I would presume at some point we're going to hear more. But, you know, this is the one I believe that that they claim they've got full, like a full close-up of a Bigfoot's face.
That's right, yes. That's the same one I'm talking about.
Yeah, nothing really new on that as far as I have heard. But yeah, if you go actually up to CryptoMundo.com, there is a story up there Hollywood Theater in local Portland, Oregon. They have an event called Tracking Truth, which is going to, it's a documentary. It's going to be taking place on the 17th of October, 7:30 p.m. It's $5, Hollywood Theater in Oregon. And they're going to be screening a documentary. It does not appear to be the one that we talked about here, but they've got something new coming up. So maybe I'll try and get more information on that, and we'll talk about that next week. But if you're in the Portland area, that might be a fun one to go to. Once again, it's Tracking Truth, October 17th, 2011, 7:30 p.m., $5 at the Hollywood Theater at Portland, Oregon. So anyway, you can go up there and check that out. But yes, I do hope they find something. And it is interesting that an actual expedition consisting of scientists is being put together to go out there, as opposed to just your normal, you know, we're cryptozoology fans. We're going to go out there and do our own little investigation. No, they've actually got a team set up to investigate. So that is very interesting.
Yeah, I definitely am interested in the results of this supposed DNA they've had tested, because that should answer a lot of questions. I mean, if it's something that's been coded before, then we'll know. And if it's not, well, then obviously we've discovered something new that we didn't know existed, and that should answer a lot of questions. I'm looking forward to that. And again, I find it totally plausible that there's some sort of animal out there that we haven't yet discovered. I mean, it happens all the time. It just so happens that this one's got a mythology attached to it, and it's maybe some close relation to humans, but it's certainly one of those things that is not out of the realm of possibility. You don't have to stretch the laws of science to make this work. There could very well be something out there we just don't know, and I would love in my lifetime to either see it proven or disproven that the Bigfoot, Yeti, Abominable Snowman, whatever, exists or doesn't exist.
The only problem with DNA, I think we have talked about this before, is that sometimes they have gotten DNA samples and the results end up coming out as inconclusive, which, you know, it does not, I mean, when your DNA, when your test comes out as inconclusive, I mean, you could at least say, well, you really can't say anything. You can't even say, oh, you know, it's a new species or anything like that. It's just inconclusive. And then you're left with even more mystery.
Oh, yeah, definitely so. And I don't even know what that means. I mean, does it mean there was a corrupt sampling? Does it mean it's something we've never seen before? I mean, what does that even mean other than inconclusive? That's as vague as you can get. Well, I hope we have something conclusive this go around.
All right, Carl, let's get some plugs in here, carlstern.com, and anything else you'd like to get out there.
Well, I'd just like to say again, carlstern.com, and you can add me on Facebook as Carl Stern, and also on Twitter as Dragon King Carl. And I tweet very frequently about updates to shows, and including After Dark and topics and stuff. So if you're interested and the stuff you hear on this show and things like it, then absolutely follow me on Twitter at Dragon King Carl.
And one last thing before we go, searching the internet here very quickly. This person here says, inconclusive DNA means that the tested DNA sample was not adequate for biological identification and could neither include nor exclude the suspected source. Inconclusive results can occur due to inadequate sample quantity or quality, or from sample tainting. So there you go. So yes, carlstern.com is the place to go. You can read more about all these stories at afterdarkradioshow.com. Join the Facebook page, click like, facebook.com/afterdarkradioshow. We'll be back in just a moment. Steven Eisenstadt talking dreams and more here at the After Dark Radio Show at afterdarkradioshow.com. We are back here on After Dark Radio. Brian Alvarez here, afterdarkradioshow.com. Pleased to be joined today by Steven Eisenstadt, PhD, the author of Dream Trending, Awakening to the Healing Power of Dreams. It's just out in paperback just a couple of weeks ago. And I want to thank Steven very much for doing the show today. I know you were traveling, and it's tough. Traveling and getting delayed and then having to do a show immediately. But thanks so much for doing this today.
You're very welcome.
Let's start by talking a little bit about dream tending and the book. For people listening right now that don't really know anything about the subject, let's do a quick overview for everybody.
Okay. Dream tending is this idea that everybody is dreaming. When our eyes are closed, something else comes awake at night. And what comes awake often are images, images that seem to be sourced by a place that's different than our ordinary awareness. So the notion of dream tending is to tend somehow to those images. And where the book takes us, which is a little different than the original or traditional approach, is instead of so immediately analyzing or interpreting dreams, we take the time to spend time, frankly, with the images themselves as they come into our experience, into our awareness.
Now, one thing about dreams, I've always been interested in this subject, and I, for whatever reason, if I don't keep a journal, I wake up and I never remember my dreams. And I know that obviously some people remember all of their dreams. Some people are forced to keep a journal. I guess how common is it to wake up in the morning and maybe the moment you wake up, you think, man, that was a weird dream. And then, like, you know, 30 seconds later, you don't remember a thing about it.
Well, with all the people that I work with, that seems to be the predominant experience, and it's my experience as well. I'll remember a dream or an image or a sense of a dream for just a moment or so, and as soon as awake life comes into my experience, the alarm goes off or people start talking or I get involved with the activities of the day, the dream just slips right away. So it is very common. And what I suggest is when we wake up in the morning and we want to remember dreams, that we bring a paper and a journal or a pencil pen right next to our bedside, and just to capture one image or one idea or one feeling, just to get that down seems to stimulate recall. We often then remember the rest of the dream.
Now we should step back here for just a moment and ask a very basic question, that being, what are dreams?
Dreams, for the most part, are stories. Stories that are being sent from a place that's different than our conscious awareness. Stories that are being sent from either what in popular psychology is called the unconscious or from a deeper source of our experience, whatever that might be. In fact, sometimes dreams are imagery that's sent from the body. If there's a disturbance in the body, an illness that's coming on, or we're feeling out of balance in some form or fashion, that particular symptom will present itself as an image in the dream. Or there's something that's happening in the circumstance of the day that gets our attention, and maybe we're not paying bringing our awareness to that. Dreams will also pick that up. They'll offer warnings, they'll offer advice, they'll offer direction. They're very extraordinary that way.
Now, I thought it was very interesting the way that you wrote about the different levels of dreams. I've had dreams before, those that I remember, and I wake up and it's like, oh, well, I know exactly why I dreamed about that. It had to do with something that happened to me yesterday. And then there are other times that I have these dreams, and they're just very strange dreams, and I wake up and I try and think about them, and I just think, why did I have this dream? What does this dream have to do with anything that's going on in my life? And I can never figure it out. And sometimes I'll think, oh, you know, maybe this was, I was thinking this because of this, some sort of analogy or something like that. But tell everybody a little bit about the different stages of dreams that people seem to have.
Well, I think that's true. I think each dream actually seems to have within it a whole variety of stages, and one image may present more significantly in one dimension than the other, but most dreams will talk to us from different perspectives. First perspective is the experiences that we encounter in everyday life, something that's going on that we've touched into or we've had direct experience with, and that will represent at night during the dream. Usually it's something that we're not paying attention to or something that needs to be underscored or something that wants to be amplified in some form. The second dimension has to do with, at the same time that's going on, you stop to wonder, well, why would the dreaming psyche pick up that particular theme or that particular set of circumstances above all other things that are happening during the day? And usually there's a relationship between whatever it is that stimulated that dream and something that's gone on in our personal history, our personal background. So there's something that's happened to us in life, a personality tendency or a pattern. Let's say, for example, that we felt rejected all our lives, that somehow we grew up in a family where, you know, we weren't really understood or we weren't really given the kind of attention that we might have deserved or wanted. So there, that feeling of not being good enough or feeling a sense of rejection or somehow marginalized. And when that comes up during the day, the dreaming psyche will pick up that circumstance, and then it will also hook into that deeper experience. And then if you take it another dimension, those feelings of being isolated or separated or rejected are themes that are in music, in great literature, in mythology. So they have not only a personal relevance, not only a historical relevance in terms of our family of origin, but have what's called an archetypal relevance. In other words, they're themes that are universal, that belong to peoples throughout the world, regardless of what ethnicity or where they grew up or so on and so forth. So sometimes, and almost always, dreams will operate on all three of those levels.
Now, I have a friend who always dreams of falling, which is obviously a very common dream. And some people have the recurring dream of waking up nude in a public place or something like that. And are these dreams that are universal all over the world? Somebody in China, for example, has the same dream of falling. And why are certain dreams of this type dreams that everyone all over the world seems to have?
Well, that's true. And falling, we'll take both of those themes, because falling is a common theme, as is waking up nude, or nudity is a common theme. But to answer the first part of the question, it's because if one can think of the imagining psyche or the dreaming psyche as yet just one of another organ, like our heart or bones, you know, structures in the body, then you can imagine that regardless of ethnicity or regardless of region you grew up in or what circumstances you grew up in, there's always common things that are similar to everybody. They're archetypical. They're typical to all people, all places. Home is an example. Everybody has a different idea of home, but everybody has the same concept of home. And the same would be true with falling. Everybody gets, regardless of what culture, what place you grew up in, this notion of to fall. I mean, everybody has that sensation of falling. So when you imagine the sensation symbolically or imaginally through metaphor or analogy, like you were suggesting, falling has to do with everything from falling apart. You know, if I'm going in life and things start to fall apart, I'm out of control and I have a sense of falling. Or the other side of that, something's way out of my control because I'm falling in love. Also, falling has to do with a certain kind of lack of esteem. I'm not feeling good about myself, so I have a sense of fall or descent, of a falling out of myself. And then, of course, the stories, the deeper stories, the second dimension that I mentioned earlier, has to do with the idea of descent. When Alice goes into Wonderland, she falls. There's a descent that happens. When Dorothy leaves, there's a descent. There's a falling into something bigger than, different than, more available and spacious than what's in ordinary awareness.
Now, you mentioned that everything dreams, and I guess the question would be, I have cats, for example, and sometimes they're sleeping and they'll start, you know, these strange body movements, you know, they'll kind of twitch a little bit or something like that. What do we know about the dreams of animals? I mean, is it similar to humans? Is it a deal where, you know, they dream that they're chasing prey? Do we know anything about whether they have dreams of falling, for example, kind of the archetypal dreams you're talking about here? Are these largely, do we believe, just across humanity, or do some animals have dreams similar to the animals that humans have?
Okay, well, that's a great question. So on one hand, because I have a cat and a dog both, and when I see their eyes twitching, I always wonder, what are they dreaming about? First, are they dreaming? And if so, what are they dreaming about, right? If only I could ask, and if only they could tell, I would know the answer to that question.
Sure.
So I really don't. I do know that, you know, we know through research that there is a dreaming process going on. You know, their minds, their brains are operating at a different level of consciousness. When we see the eyes, that's called REM, rapid eye movement, when we see that happening, we know that there's a different neurological rhythm that's happening. So we imagine that there's something similar to the human dreaming experience. But we, of course, can't ask and tell, and, you know, really get curious about. Now, the other part of that question, though, gets really interesting, and that is everything is dreaming. And that's an old idea that's just making itself back now into modern time, into our times. Everything is dreaming, not just animals like our cats or our dogs, but trees and oceans and mountains, you know, and buildings that you can even imagine it to. Now, they don't dream the same way humans dream, of course, but, you know, we always know that there's something about the spirit of the lake, you know, or the soul of a tree or something. We have a sense internally, and people have shared stories forever about that, that there's a spirit of place that has a dreamlike quality to it. And we can imagine that when a grove of redwood trees, for example, gets cut down, that there's something that happens on that landscape that's painful. There's a scream that goes out, let's say, and that could be picked up in the dreams of people. So when the ecological trouble that happens in the world, when we're out of balance, it could be imagined easily that when an ocean gets polluted or when a forest gets cut down, or anything of that nature, that there is something of the environment or of the planet itself, the world itself, that is dreaming. And, of course, where we pick that up would be in the dreams of people.
The reason I asked about the cats is because I was once told that there is a some sort of, I don't know if substance is the right word, but it is released when you sleep that paralyzes you. So, for example, you know, if I'm dreaming about running, I don't just jump up and start running. You know, I'm sleeping in bed and I'm paralyzed during this dream. And you know, I was once told that they had done experiments with cats where they removed however they did it, the cats were not paralyzed during sleep and they would move around like they were hunting. And so the conclusion was, you know, the cats are dreaming that they're hunting. So I didn't know if maybe there had been any other sort of experiments like that. I mean, if a cat were lying on its side and it suddenly righted itself, maybe you'd think, huh, the cat dreamed it was falling. And it jumped to its feet. So I don't know if there had been any sort of experiments like that, but something I've always just been intrigued by.
Been intrigued by, yeah. Well, what we do know is that with people, when they're dreaming, and there's lots of activity, there's running away, let's say a lion is chasing a person through the forest, you know. And if you go back to our idea that dreams come in different levels, you know, the first idea is, you know, you saw a picture of a lion that day, or you saw a movie or something, you read something about it in a book. And so it's recapturing that notion and presenting it in a dream. Or the idea is that there's something lion-like that is aggressive, if the dream in fact shows an aggressive lion, and that you go back into your work setting or into a relational setting, and you see that there's something aggressive that was kind of moving towards you that day. Or, you know, on an archetypal level, you imagine that there's something regal that's being presented that's trying to get your attention. And so you have this lion that could be imagined as something regal in certain cultures and certain stories, and that's trying to pull at you and ask for attention. But to answer that other idea, yeah, you know, when you wake up in the morning, sometimes you feel exhausted. It's as if you actually are, your body is actually working the same time that the dream is happening. You are having an embodied experience that is picking up some of that energetic force that's going on and trying to escape from that particular creature.
You know, it's fascinating you mentioned that, because that was my next question. I wrestled for many years, and sometimes I will have dreams of wrestling, and I will wake up just covered in sweat.
Yeah.
And I always wonder, it's like, you know, did I put too many blankets on and I began sweating, and thus I had this dream about doing an activity that involved sweat? Or was it a deal where I had a dream about wrestling that was so real to me at the time that I began sweating, even though I was not wrestling or even moving around at all?
Yeah, remember dream. Yes, exactly. And remember, dreams are always talking in metaphor, right? There's always something about a dream that is pulling at our life strings. You know, dream tending, the book, gives just numbers of exercises as to how to work with those kinds of dreams. You're dreaming of wrestling, and, you know, there's something about that wrestling. First, you're having an embodied response. Your body is responding, so you're sweating. But also, is there something that is going on in life at the moment that has to do with a wrestling match of some sort? Are you wrestling with an issue of the day? Are you wrestling with an idea, with a concept, something in a relationship, so on and so forth? And it does create a certain kind of response from the body, and we wake up in sweat. We wake up sometimes terrified. We wake up sometimes exhilarated, you know. We actually have a response to the imagery that's coming forward at night. And the key is, how do you listen to that imagery, not only to see it and know it more fully, but to hear the intelligence that's living behind it? What does that wrestling dream asking of me now? What is it about wrestling in the dream that's important in my life at the moment?
What is the process behind, for example, if I'm having a dream? This actually happened to me. I'm starting to remember these things now. Having a dream, and it's a very bad dream. It's a nightmare. And something terrible is happening. And at some point, before I wake up, very shortly before I wake up, while I'm still dreaming of this circumstance, I suddenly tell myself, it's a dream. Everything is okay now. And I kind of calm down a little bit in the dream, and then shortly thereafter I wake up. Is this something in my imagination, or do these sorts of things actually happen in the dream itself?
Well, for some people, not often, but for some people, they will bring conscious awareness or a sense of safety into the dream because the dream is so frightening or so scary or so terrifying that in order to just calm oneself, there's this idea where the dreamer in the dream begins to offer some kind of support or some kind of comfort, and then it allows a person to wake up more easily. Remember Sigmund Freud, the person that wrote The Interpretation of Dreams almost more than a century ago now, said that dreaming itself is a way of keeping the things that are latent, that are really difficult and problematic, and that are at the seat of our anxiety and our aggression. The dreams themselves keep that energy in play, in place, so that when we can wake up, we cannot have our sleep interrupted, so to speak. But I think more to the point, people wake up from a nightmare, and most often they're not comforted. Most often we're just gripped by the sheer force of whatever it is that came through the night, right? And our first response, naturally, we're human, our first response is to seek comfort, to either distance ourselves from it or to somehow figure out that it's only a dream, or sometimes we'll think of the scary thing that happened, like a tidal wave just flooding over the house and the fear of being taken over by the whole thing, or a whole number of things, or falling off a cliff would be another one. And I think we try to somehow move away from the imagery, and the idea of dream tending is to not move away, not seek comfort so quickly, but to really tend or attend to the images themselves. There's something about that quality of falling or about that big tidal wave that's coming to engulf the house that is important to us. There's something that's trying to break through, get our attention, and inform us. So it's a question of how do you find the safety in order to allow those images to show themselves and not be so overwhelming or frightening.
Some people will sit in a college lecture and they'll be bored, and the next thing you know, they're daydreaming about something. What is the difference between a daydream and a dream that you experience when you're sleeping at night?
Well, in the work that I do, where dream tending, where it's a way of being along with the images, the daydream and the night dream, they're different for sure, but they're not completely different. So I don't separate the two. I differentiate between the two, which is just another way of saying that the way that I work with a daydream would be very similar to the way that I would work with a night dream. I call them waking dreams, that people are forever dreaming. You're walking down the street, and all of a sudden it just becomes quite extraordinary, right? There's something that happens that it's almost as if I've been here before, or the place just shows itself in a different quality, or I'm walking on a trail in nature and, an extraordinary animal just tends to walk by, or the wind is blowing through the trees and I'm in a dream-like quality. And I experience all of that as a kind of dreaming state. And I work with all that as if it were a dream. So I differentiate between the two. They're different because we're coming from a different neurological place. But at the same time, the images, when we work with them, when we tend to them, rather than to so quickly interpret or analyze them, when we allow them their own place, their own intelligence, their own presentation, something quite extraordinary reveals. And so I work with them really very similarly.
I was watching a video, an interview that you did, and you said something very interesting, that being that if you go, I believe you said, 3 days without dreaming, you can become psychotic.
Yeah, and that is, there's something about dreaming, the function of dreaming, that is absolutely important in terms of survival. So we need to eat, we need to drink, right? And we need to sleep. But it's not just sleep. We need to sleep and drop into a dreamlike REM state of consciousness, the rapid eye movement, the dream state. And for whatever reason, it's restorative, it's healthy, and necessary. And if they because they can wake us up in the sleep labs right as we're going into the dream experience, even though often we're not even conscious that we're having a dream at night. But, you know, they can measure and they can watch your eyes flutter and they can measure what's going on in the mind and the brain. And when they wake us up, right before we go into that state, and then we go back to sleep. But then they wake us up right before we go back into that state. If they keep doing that, in 2 to 3 days, we will not feel rested at all. In fact, we'll start hallucinating and trying to recapture whatever is required, whatever is going on in the dreaming. So you're right. We do go kind of nuts if we don't have that kind of experience.
I've noticed this. My wife noticed this as well. I actually didn't notice it until she brought it up, and I was like, yeah, you're right. When I get sick, for example, and I need to take some NyQuil to sleep through the night, NyQuil and sometimes some other sleeping medications, that sort of thing, it seems that when you sleep while taking NyQuil before bed, you have far stranger and more vivid dreams. I don't know if that's true. I don't know if you've ever done any investigation into that, or if maybe just there's something about I wake up and I remember the weird dreams because I've been taking NyQuil. I don't know. But it always does seem that if I have to take NyQuil before bed, I have some really, sometimes very disturbing dreams.
Yeah, I think people throughout the ages have ingested everything from NyQuil to A, B, C, D, and E, right? And they have stimulated dream recall. So yes, I do believe. I mean, people report that everywhere I go, that when they ingest everything from cold medicine to anything else, that there is a significant impact on remembering dreams. And often they are kind of disturbing or peculiar or bizarre or out of the ordinary. But I really want to make the point that the dreams that are out of the ordinary, the dreams that are most peculiar, even those dreams that are most frightening, not good to get traumatized. I mean, I'm not advocating that at all. But to find a way of being really in our sense of comfort, in our sense of authority, a way of being rooted so that we can really witness or tend to those peculiar, odd, sometimes horrific images. It's just filled with useful information because at that moment in time, something else is coming through our experience. We're not in the routine of the day. We're not kind of in the homogenized culture. We're so bombarded by information every hour of every day now, right, that we're almost programmed by the advertising industry and everything else. There's so much information coming at us that hardly do we have the time to really connect to our indigenous nature, our particular authenticity. And as peculiar as it sounds, and I know it sounds peculiar, sometimes the more odd the dream, the more nightmarish, the more out of the ordinary, in fact, really links back to something that is most authentic to us personally. Now, I'm not saying that it were odd or weird or peculiar. I'm just suggesting that the imagery itself is sometimes rooted in a sense of our own particularity, and we have that moment to experience ourselves separate from the dominant culture and everything that we've been programmed into, either by our family or by other people's expectations or our own expectations or all the information we've ingested that day. Something about our own particular innate nature often will come through the dreams that are the most peculiar and bizarre.
How profound do you feel the changes can be in a person's life? Somebody who, like me, wakes up, totally forgets their dream immediately, as opposed to somebody who wakes up, they write down their dream, they tend to the dream. You mentioned advice often given in dreams. What are some of the stories of individuals maybe that you've worked with that started started tending to their dreams and found great success in their waking life?
Oh, there's stories upon stories. I mean, some of the great inventions in humankind as a result of dreams. You know, the benzene ring was a result of a dream. Relativity theory was a result of a dream. I mean, dreams will come forward and will listen and will hear not only the present, not only echoes of the past, but will hear the call of the future moving through the imagery of dreams. So yeah, it's quite profound, actually, when people have the opportunity to remember dreams and recall and then begin to tend to them. And in the book Dream Tending, they're just very specific exercises, because a lot of people don't remember their dreams, you know, and a lot of people remember dreams differently. Some people remember them in pictures. Some people remember them in sound and gesture, you know, and just some people remember dream in terms of a deep feeling that happened during the night. So there's multiple ways that dreams are recollected. And then there are different ways of remembering dreams, you know, things that you can share with yourself at night or tell yourself that will help recollection. But once we get to the recollection, once we are able to present the dream, either writing it in a journal or drawing it or sketching it, and then bringing our awareness to tend to the dream, it just changes life completely. You know, we have access to an intelligence that is beyond our conscious knowing. There we have access to the deeper resources of ourselves. It's just quite helpful.
Now, let me ask this question. If for those, obviously, they can buy the book, Dream Tending, Awakening to the Healing Power of Dreams, which is out right now in paperback. Any quick advice to somebody who, let's say tomorrow I wanted to start a process of dream tending, or at least at the very least writing down my dreams? I know personally, I have sometimes woken up from a dream, and it's like, it's so vivid, and it, I feel like it's so important that I'll actually write it down and go back to sleep. But then when I wake up in the morning and I look at what I wrote down, it's like I can't even interpret what I said. It's almost as strange as the dream itself. What are some tips as far as being able to capture what you were dreaming about the night before?
Mm-hmm. Three tips. One is, you said right at the beginning of the show, analogy. When you write down that dream, even though it seems peculiar, and it is, it's in dream language, it's not rational nor linear often, it's very peculiar, and what the heck is this, right? It seems so impossible the moment that we wake up. So three tips. One is to sketch it, to, once it's written down, go through the dream, just say it out loud and see which of the images stand out, and there may be one or two or three images that stand out more than the others, and sketch them, make a picture of them, you know? The second idea is to really notice how the dream, one thing follows the next. When this happened in the dream, then this happened. When this happened in the dream, then this happened. And you go through the dream just in that kind of order, and you allow the dream then to present itself as if it were a story, which is the third tip. Tell the dream out loud. Write it down. If you can share it with somebody, all the better. But just allow yourself to tell the dream out loud as if it were a story, and then listen, wait, and don't get caught by the peculiarity or the bizarre nature of it. Allow the dream itself to present, and just simply bring a witnessing presence to the presentation, and often the dreams will open up. Dreams really lend themselves to analogy. So when you go through the dream, this animal, this creature, this scary fall that's happened, it is like what? And then you go to the next image. This particular landscape, it is like what? What is it reminding me of? What does it connect to? What is the analogy that it's... And if you just keep playing the what it's like game, that will often open up the dream. And then one last thing that I think is just remarkable. If a person is working on their own, because it's really difficult to work with your own dreams often, because, you know, we don't get them from the beginning. So here we are trying to struggle through them to figure them out. One way of doing that is to write the dream down. You've already got it down once. So write the same dream down a second time and even a third time, literally writing the dream down two times after the first presentation. And then find a piece of the dream. Maybe it's a segment or a character, and write it poetically. I mean, we're all not poets, of course, and I don't mean to write it as beautiful poetry. Simply write it out spontaneously or poetically and see what then comes forward. And more often than not, I would say 8 times out of 10, when we get to that place, the dream itself will start to reveal, show itself, and offer something of its value or merit to us.
One more question about dreams, and I want to ask you a quick question about yourself and the book. How long is a dream? I've read before that sometimes some people believe that the dream is actually, it takes place in an instant, even if it's a dream that to you felt like it was an hour long. If it's a dream that feels like it's an hour long, am I actually engaged in this dream for a full hour before I wake up, or is it something that happened in an instant and I don't even know, I don't understand the mechanics of it, but it happens in an instant and I remember long, great details?
Yeah, it used to be, the thought used once upon a time was that, you know, it's just an instant, and yet it seems like it's, you know, because we're out of traditional time and the chronology of time and space, and it was an instant, but it felt like forever. The new research suggests that the amount of time that you feel like you're in the dream, that full hour, is probably the amount of time that you are in that dream state. So it seems that there seems to be more of a correlation to the actual length of the dream, similar to the length of the experience that you're having while asleep. Yeah.
Well, last question here. My wife went to Peru in college, mm-hmm. and part of the deal was they sat down with a shaman and took ayahuasca. And, of course, she had some very vivid visions of all sorts of things. And in fact, if you read about visions people have when they take ayahuasca, there a lot of people have the same visions, which I always thought was fascinating. But how does that compare to your average dream that you experience at night? I don't know how much you've studied this. Is it similar? Is it more vivid? Are they two completely different things?
When you're ingesting ayahuasca and when you're working in the presence of a shaman, there's a field that gets activated, right? And it's both chemically induced, and it's both in the presence of the figure, the person, the shaman, and you're often with other people. So the field itself gets activated, and there's another dimension, a transpersonal, let's say, dimension of experience that people seem to dip into. However, the same thing happens nightly when we are dreaming, which is another way of saying when the dreams come to visit us, right? We always think that we're the ones that are dreaming, but when we actually think of the dream, we often see ourselves in the dream. So then the question becomes, if we're in the dream, who's dreaming the dream? It's the who that's dreaming the dream that gets fascinating, and that takes us to a different dimension of experience. When we're at that dimension of experience, it is as if we're in a trance state. It is as if the field has been activated and that we can begin to navigate and, with some experience, move around a bit and discover all kinds of things.
Quick question for you before we wrap it up, just kind of a personal question here. When did you first get interested in this topic? What were some of the things in your life that occurred where you decided that this was something that really interested you and eventually became your life's work?
I think when I was 10 to 12 years old, I remember going to a beach here in California. And I'd always go with my parents, and we'd go across the mountains to this beach. And, you know, it was a big beach, big, big public beach with glaring signs that said food here, you know, and a giant parking lot. Mm-hmm. And my parents told me time after time, never go around that bend, you know, on the other side of that. That bend there is not a public beach, but that's a different beach, kind of like a wilderness beach, where you just don't want to go there. It's not safe. Well, of course, you know, I'm just at that age, so I wander off, meander over to the other side. Tide is down, you know, tide is low. And I'm sitting on a rock, you know, just in a tide pool and sitting there. And I'm thinking to myself, my goodness, this is kind of like a dream that I had. And also, it's as if the rocks and the shells and this tide pool could talk. It has a voice. And right at that moment, right at that very moment, this hero came by. You know, that means at 10, a 17-year-old, because
sure.
that's really important. And he came by and he said to me, do you know that rocks can talk? And I said, oh, my God. I knew that or thought that because kids are permeable, have an active imagination, but I didn't know anybody else would imagine that. And that's what he said. And I thought, my goodness gracious, that's kind of like this dream. And I walked then back around. Tide, of course, had come in. I walked around to the other side, you know, where the big glaring food. So I was on the other side, not the civilized side, not the tame side, not the safe side, but on the other side of the. And from that moment on, I was fascinated by altered states of consciousness, by dream life and fantasy and active imagination, and really appreciating that there's more to life than what first meets the eye, than what first meets the ego. That there's a whole range of experience, a creative, animated, extraordinary resource, capacity that all of us have that comes out at night when our eyes go down. Or during the day in that instance, because it was a dream-like experience.
And very quickly, give everybody a list of some of the other books that you have worked on as well, tackling not just this subject, but some other subjects as well.
Well, dream tending, of course, is what I do, and that's the book that people really find of most value because it's a step-by-step process of working with dream. The other books that I have been part of is something called The Imagination of Medicine, and that is the idea that dreams themselves really support our healing process. They're adjunct to a good medical care, and there's medicines in dreams. So one of the chapters in Dream Tending is Medicines of the Soul, but that gets elaborated on in this other book text called Imagination of Medicine. And then I've taken dream work into the world of business and have written an article on dream and how dream supports an entrepreneurial and a business capacity. Because people that are effective in their entrepreneurial way really also have the capacity to vision or to dream. I mean, we're all caught now with the story of Steve Jobs, and there's something about an intuitive, creative life that's informed by the way of the dream that generates in people capacities to invent, innovate, and to succeed, whether it be in business, art, culture. It's just an extraordinary resource. So I've done some writing in that as well.
I want to make sure to get a chance to get some plugs out here today. Obviously, the book Dream Tending, Awakening to the Healing Power of Dreams, available in bookstores everywhere, Amazon.com. And I know you do a lot of workshops as well. So if you'd like to talk a little bit about that and any websites that people can go to for more information.
Yeah, thank you. Dream Tending is a website, and they can go to dreamtending.com. .edu or Dream Tending. You can just Google Dream Tending and it'll immediately come up in five different places. And there are workshops. I do workshops, both beginning workshops, intermediate workshops. I do Dream Tending training workshops. I do retreats where people come and work with Dream. And people find it absolutely extraordinary and helpful. The idea is not to really woo anybody or to really convince or to push people, but to really offer people specific skills and tools in ways that they can work with their dream and discover what the imagery really has to offer to them personally. The key in the whole idea is that the intelligence that lives in the images of dream is so extraordinary that when we gain access to that particular kind of intelligence, it really supports our own way of being and really informs who we are and what we're about.
DreamTending.com is a place to go. There's also a link to a Facebook page, Pacifica Graduate Institute, Attaining Skills in the Craft of Dream Tending. That's taking place November 11th through 13th, 2011. There is a link to Pacifica Graduate Institute as well. And of course, as noted, the book and the website. And Stephen, I want to thank you so much for doing the show today. I so much appreciate it. I know the problems you had with travel this afternoon, but you still made it here, so I very much appreciate it. And I'd love to have you back on the show again someday.
I'd be delighted. Thank you so much.
Thank you again. And of course, thanks everybody for listening. We shall talk to you again after a while.